I was just reading the introduction to this, and it says, a unique collaboration among geneticists, plant physiologists, remote sensing experts, and plant breeders. So I think I'm the unique physiologist in the presentation. But thank you very much for accepting my suggestion. I've got to give you a warning. This is a physiology talk to a large extent. And I kind of tricked you all by telling you that I was going to talk about QTL discovery in general. But what I want to do is talk a little bit more about a topic that probably appears a bit more in C2, actually, in these types of meetings, which is related to how we're trying to understand abiotic stress and breeding for adaptation in Australia. So I work for CSIRO, which is our National Research Institute, and I've got to turn this around the right way. Yep. And a lot of the work I'm going to talk about today is with three PhD students, one from China, from Beijing University, Taiwan, another one with UQ, Zumi Wang and Daniela Bustos-Kortz from Wageningen. I'm going to go through some stories around that. And I note that one of the chairs is talking after me, so I guess he'll be tough. if some of you were able to attend the talks this morning from the Crop Ecophysiology Group, we'll have seen some talks there about of applications of physiology and modelling in breeding programs, and a really successful demonstration of that by researchers at Pioneer using developing Aquamax. And you'll hear another story about that, I think, in the C1 session tomorrow, as Art Cooper is talking about it. I'm not going to talk a lot about how do we know what we don't know. I'm not going to talk a lot about prediction and simulation. Often, if you come to one of my talks, you'll get drowned with thousands of simulations. I'm not going to do that today. I'm going to talk more about how we develop some of the technology that goes behind that. So I want to focus more on measurement. And so when I say, how do we know what we don't know, it's as much about how do we measure things that we want to understand, and how do we use that information in understanding adaptation for yield. And I'll give some areas, some examples that are around leaf area in wheat, maize and sorghum. So if you want the shortcut version, go and read this paper that I wrote with Fred Van Awijk from Wageningen back in 2010. It's got a full story of how we've used crop physiology to understand leaf growth as affected by temperature, VPD and soil water deficit. And we've integrated that, and that was work done by INRA researchers in Montpellier. We integrated that inside a crop simulation model so that we could use environment data to simulate phenotypes. So we can simulate yield with these types of crop models, being driven by QTLs through sub-processes in the model. Now, we don't claim to simulate genotypes perfectly. What we're trying to do is simulate populations of genotypes. And then one of the things I've been doing with Fred is giving him and his team data sets and saying to them, okay, this is a physiologically completely simulated data set. Try and apply some of your statistical methods to it to recover the QTL. So he's been using methodologies to try to rediscover the QTLs that went in all the way up here. So it's a platform to allow you to do that. And we've also done that where we simulate thousands of data sets, where we change the weather data, the soil data, the genetic models, and see if we can rediscover them. So it's a discovery tool, an exploration tool. But I'm going to talk more about measurement, and I better speed up a little bit. What we're trying to deal with when we put crop models into a system is we're trying to deal with all of this interaction of traits across scales. The fact that genes affect traits that provide adaptation through the season. We had a couple of questions before about QTL that are related to spikelet number or grains per spike or whatever. Just forget all that stuff. You're not going to be able to select very easily for most of those types of traits because the environment's going to kill you in the end. It's going to wipe out a lot of those traits. There are very few of those traits we haven't really fixed. If you're working in a really unexplored species, or you're working with really diverse material, you might be able to bring some adaptation in, but researching for that within populations is challenging, I would say, without being rude. So what we're interested in trying to deal with this is this long phenotypic distance. The fact that we're trying to get from a gene to a crop, we can get back to some point using crop models and phenotypic measurements, the types of things you'll see in some presentations at this meeting, high throughput this sort of non-linear effect at some point where we're getting all of these combinations of processes providing quite complex reactions depending on what environment you're growing in. So when you do a QTL experiment in one year or one location and you do it in another one and you get a completely different set of answers, these things are all behind how we're trying to interpret that. So one way to do it is to simulate everything and try to understand how do these things change. Another way is to bring phenotyping and simulation together. So there's a few references down here. Some recent ones that Charlie Messina referred to this morning and Mark will probably refer to again tomorrow. But what we're trying to do is work within this sort of dual model, which has genetics and understanding on this side. We're trying to process information through a crop model and feed that back into predicting new phenotypes and then dissecting new aspects of those phenotypes. So we might try to improve our measurement of how leaf area changes. This is a UAB photo of some wheat genotypes, and try and work out how to improve this part of the model so that we can do a better job of detecting QTL. So, I'm not going to expect you to understand this one straight away. There'll be a test later. This is a summary of the science that's behind the Apsim sorghum model, and it's pretty straightforward. It's just crop physiology. So, we have environment inputs of basically weather data and soil water. We have parameters, these grey things, leaf appearance rate, extinction coefficient for a canopy, the radiation use efficiency is dependent on that, how well you capture light as you go into a canopy. Leaf initiation rate, radiation use efficiency, how efficiently the canopy works, and then some traits associated with water use, transpiration efficiency, how fast the roots elongate, and how well they explore the soil. Now, all of these are our targets for phenotyping. So you'll hear lots of people talking about high throughput phenotyping methods. They'll talk about trying to measure things like leaf area, or they'll be trying to measure how many plants there are, or how long they are, or how tall they are. We're actually trying to target these things, and we're not just trying to target these parameters in a single experiment. We want to target their response. We want to understand how they respond to environment variables, because that's the information that feeds into the model. And through this whole process, we work out light interception, crop growth rate, water capture, crop growth rate, and we arbitrate to work out yield. But I won't go into that here. So I want to give three sets of examples here. One about estimating genotypic parameters for leaf area and wheat, some new work we're working on now. A simple question about phenotyping, and just some mention of Zumi's work on GS and sorghum, which has only just started, so it's a short talk. So we just published a little paper on this in JXB that Tao was working on. So we were taking a little camera and taking photos of small seedlings of wheat and then reconstructing the dynamics of leaf area so we could calculate the plant height, the leaf growth rate, the tiller number, total leaf number. We could compute all of these parameters from an automated taking photos every week of these little plants and building this. And so this comparison here and in the paper is to compare high and low vigour wheat. So we're trying to develop wheat that's competitive against weeds and that actually establishes ground cover quickly so it minimises loss of water. Then another technology that we're using, this is Jose Jimenez-Bernie using a phenomobile field in Yanco in southern Australia. So with this type of technology, which has got a LiDAR on it, and not with wheat this short. I mean, that's actually very short wheat. This wheat's a metre tall, so not the same data. But we're able to develop these leaf area sort of nitrogen profiles. Where is the nitrogen and the leaf area distributed through the canopy? So that, you can see, can feed into how do we calculate an extinction coefficient for the crop. So how does it capture light and how does that translate to crop growth rate? Then another technology we're using is to use small UAVs to capture images. And I actually actually cheated here. Those are actually images by someone taking them. But you'll have to believe me that we can get this quality of image from our UAV as well. But the way that we're using this is that if you take, in this case, it's one genotype in... Sorry, these are two different genotypes. We're fixing their development, so we're going to run the model and we're going to input the leaf area into the model. Well, not going to input it, we're going to compare the model to that. We're going to run the model across a whole lot of settings to try to reproduce this ground cover. And we want to reproduce this ground cover for two different genotypes. That, when we've done that, and we've run the model hundreds of times, and we've subset parameters that will match this, we can reproduce these leaf area curves. Now, why would we do that? The reason we want to reproduce those LAI curves is that then we can produce the biomass curve. So I'm showing you measured data here, but we can predict it. So we didn't tune the model to do this. We tuned it only on ground cover. So we've tuned the model on UAV data, and we're predicting biomass with the model. And the objective of that, for us, is actually to get at water use. So I'm not going to go and try and predict the yield of all the genotypes. What I want to do is predict the potential water use and the supply-demand ratio for different genotypes. And this shows you this genotype here going under stress as it goes through the season. One would be no stress, so this one's going under stress. This one, the way that it's developed its leaf area and used the water, it's delayed that stress. So that information, I'm just trying to explain that, you know, if you want to start using models in breeding, you have to start collecting data from glasshouse experiments to populate these parameters, like this is specifically nitrogen, and then you're starting to use the model to test it against variables that are generated by the model, including leaf area. To explain that this has to be a comprehensive approach to this. We can't really just go out there and use a HTP vehicle and be able to do this kind of work to infer those types of relationships. We can start doing that, but if we want to fine-tune it and start to select for different traits, we're going to have to use a model as a way of sampling the environment. So we've got known inputs for phenology associated with major genes. So to predict flowering time, we can predict flowering time for our wheats in Australia across the entire wheat belt. We've done it for 6,000 locations. We do it every year with the new genotypes. We do glasshouse experiments to get this leaf growth response. And to pick up the tillering response, we then do the field phenotyping. So that allows us to predict these genotypes or these phenotypes that we didn't know. Briefly introduce this one. I'm not sure, David, how badly I'm going on time.
You're fine.
I'm fine.
Yeah.
I can use as much time as I want.
Yeah.
Okay. Slow down. So there's an example that's just recently published by Jessica Kelsey and Jesse Boland. Jesse, are you going to talk about this at the meeting or didn't? No. Okay. So the example of this work was using UAVs to characterise NDVI, ground cover through the season, in Simmet's breeding program, and to look at how those relate to yield. So could you build a genome prediction model around that type of phenotyping? But those were basically being put into the model as covariates. So what I've been doing with Daniela and Fred, say, okay, let's run some simulations, just completely simulated data, where we create a genetic model, we create a whole set of genotypes, we pretend to grow them, we produce the biomass, the leaf area, and so on, and then we test that to see, could we work out how would you best use a UAV to sample through the season? So this is an example here. It's a biomass, but you can think of it as a surrogate for the NDVI measurement. And these are different genotypes that we've generated. So we've artificially generated this data. And what we're now trying to do is say, well, how do we make best use of that now? And one of of the things we can do is we can say, well, what if we were sampling 6 times in the season, or what if we were sampling 11 times or 21 times? So if you know, how frequently do you have to fly? Now, I know no breeder in the room is going to say, yeah, I can fly a UAV 21 times in every trial I have, right? You're not going to say that. Although I have a friend who has something to tell you, if you do want to do that. So he's got a little UAV that lives in a garbage bin, and you just put it out there and it flies whenever you want it to. So it'll actually go and do that. So you can do it, but it's very expensive, and someone might steal it. So it might not be the best way to do it. But what Fred's been looking at with his team is to see if we fit a spline through this data, how many samples do we need, and how efficiently could we predict biomass with this type of approach. And I won't go into a lot of the detail on it. We're still trying to write it up, so we're trying to find a right angle on it. But the basic result we had was that if we took the raw data, so there's noisy data, and we had a low heritability, so we generated a population that had a low heritability as well. That was the base data, right? So if we then fitted a spline through it with 6 observations or 6 knots in it, so as if you did 6 flights, you could improve this heritability a lot. So just the process of pulling a spline through it gave us a much better capability of predicting this biomass at the end of the period. And we've been playing with the genetic parameters, trying to look at different genetic models and work out how much noise we can deal with, but I won't go into detail here. I haven't really got time. So that's one way of how we can use that information to try to decide how do we best use phenotype to understand these things that are behind the QTLs we want to measure. Now, the last thing I'm going to talk about is the outline of what Zumi's doing. I really don't have much data at all on this at the moment because Zumi's only just started working on this. Research, but it's based on a whole lot of work that we've done for the last 15 years in this area, and that I think if you saw Charlie Messina's talk this morning, you will have heard that it works, or at least for commercial maize in the US, and I guess we're doing something similar in sorghum, but trying to integrate a little bit differently into our simulation models and try some new ideas in adapting sorghum to Australian environments. Firstly, you have to understand, the average yield of sorghum in Australia is only about 2.5 tonnes per hectare. So it's really low. We're dealing with water as our major limit, which is actually really good because we can do a really good job of modelling the environmental impact of water on genotype variability on the use of that water through the season. But how we use that water is a very important part of adaptation. And the biggest challenge for the breeders is this target population of environment. So if you think about 50 years worth of climate in across this sorghum belt in Australia, which is about 1,000 kilometres in longitude, in 50 years we generate a huge number of environments and a huge number of different types of drought stress. So when you sample 1 year, you really have a bad sample of what potentially your cultivar, your hybrid is going to deal with. So what we're trying to do is understand how this variation in water use can influence adaptation and whether we can compensate for that. So if you look at different patterns of LAI, here's a genotype that flowers late and has high tillery and it gets itself into a lot of stress very quickly. So we're trying to work out how to balance that out across different seasons. So sometimes you want tillering with early, you want tillering and earliness, but you don't want tillering with lateness, because you're trying to manage that canopy. And it makes a really complex interaction, and this is some calculations we've done with David's data. This is flowering date here. And so you can see as tillering increases within a 45-day flowering date, your yield goes up. So you get to a 60-day date, this is in one location, your yield starts going down when you increase the tillers. So tillers become positive here and negative here. So How can we use phenomics to understand that? Well, we can use phenomics because we can count the heads from a UAV, and we can estimate flowering date very well. So we're starting to use that as input information. So here's our head counting algorithm. It's got about we're up to about 88% regression on that now, R squared. We think we can do better. Actually, it's the first thing I'm doing when I get back. But we're trying to monitor check genotypes. So in David's breeding trials, we're measuring for two check genotypes. We're using those genotypes to parameterize the environment inputs to APSIM, which is our simulation model. So that lets us characterize the soil and set it up. And then we measure flowering time and fertile tiller number, and we want to use UAVs to do it. At the moment, Zoomy's out there counting stuff, but the UAVs will be doing it next year. And we run simulations of all of those genotypes. And what we then do is essentially we predict yield, but then we calculate a residual. So you imagine you've got the observed yields, or deviations of those, and we've got predicted yields. But the predicted yields, we've already built in the flowering date and the number of tillers for each genotype. So if you then calculate a residual, if you find a genotype that's got a big difference between the predicted and the observed, that genotype has something you don't know about, right? So it's a genotype you want. I can't tell you what trait it's got, but there's something special about it that should mean you should select it. So that's the basis of what we're trying to do, to try to use physiology to remove what we know and select for what we don't know. So we're actually going to select for stuff that we don't know, but we know it's useful, but we don't know what it is, which is what breeders do anyway, right? So anyway, I won't spend any time on this slide. This is a first go at trying to get this working, running the model at different flowering dates and different tillering. I just want to go through a summary that we can measure things at the glasshouse level. We can use reverse modelling to try to predict new phenotypes like biomass and water use. We can use this technology to look at g-by-environment data sets and understand how do we do high throughput phenotypes and how do we analyse it, how do we statistically analyse it. And we're hoping that we'll be able to apply this in a GWAS approach to find the genes that are associated with the things that we don't know, or the things we don't understand. And with that, I'm going to stop right there and thank my students in particular and also my colleagues at CSIRO, UQ, DAP and Wageningen. And I've got to give another talk on Wednesday at first thing in the morning, where I plan to think about giving a US election update from an Australian perspective, but I don't have any sort of, you know, what do you call those shield things, so I probably won't say anything at all, but if you want to come along, I'd be happy to see you again. Thank you. I think One of the challenges is trying to understand how the environment varies at the plot level, and so how, when you're running a breeding trial and you've got 4-row or 10-row plots or something, and you're trying to understand how the environment changes between those and how you monitor that. I think if we had a bunch of wireless sensors and systems, we would start to do that, and we would model it. We wouldn't try to measure it at all the plots, but we've been starting to try to do that. So I have networks of thermal sensors where I have 120 of them on every plot. Not 120 on a plot, but 120, one per plot. And then I'm trying to subsample that and understand that and then use UAV thermal data to get the spatial resolution. So I think we're starting to try to get towards those technologies. I think I wouldn't overdo some of the work, though, because there's a lot of useful work in phenotyping in being thorough and understanding how plants grow and detailing it nicely. But we don't do any 3D reconstruction of that. The wheat example is only for some glasshouse work to understand things like leaf appearance rate and so on. And I wouldn't advocate that as a high throughput system. It's actually quite automatic. There's only one step that's not, but it's still a lot of work. So I don't know. I think we still want to, it's like all of these technologies, you still want to push the envelope on making use of it, seeing that it can work. And I think it's really important that people push it to try to understand if they can measure the differences between the genotypes. I think the question that often doesn't get asked, number one, people don't talk to plant breeders, right? So last meeting I gave a talk at, I asked that question. I said, how many, there were a whole bunch of modelers and physiologists in there. How many of you know a plant breeder? Only about 3% of them did or talked to one. So firstly, you need to know what plant breeding needs, and secondly, you need to know what resolution of power is needed for a decision to be changed. I think that should be the driving force, is how much precision do I need? So with canopy temperature, we need really fine precision to tell the difference between two genotypes. It's easier to tell if they need irrigated. They need irrigation, but to tell the difference between them is really difficult. Sorry, that's a long answer, but good question. Yeah, that's part of what Danielle is going to be testing. I think the question is going to be, well, ideally that's what's going to happen, because I think in most cases if you're going to use UAVs or tools like that, it's probably going to be of the order of maybe 3 times in a season, or maybe 5, but 3 more likely. She's having a look at that. I guess what we would try to do, and what we do with sorghum, is that if we characterise the check genotype well enough, if we have one measurement of its leaf area, we can extrapolate towards that and then try to extrapolate all the others as well. So I think we would try to replace some of that with a model, a crop model, which I didn't show here. I was just showing a spline, but I think that's how we approach it. The same way that we're going to try and do zoomings, so, with a very low number. Sorry, generates T by E worse or?
Generates T by E, the simplest genetic model or simplest single environment model or environment factors or combinations?
I guess we were pretty surprised at how much T by E we could generate with this work back in when we did this in May. So if you have a look at that, I'll just leave the paper up there. But this one. And there was another one in genetics that we did. So if you look at that, that was also her as the author. We could generate a fair bit of GBI in that. We were very surprised at how much we generated, and having leaf growth responding to temperature with a sort of a 10 or 20% difference in slope response, and the same for BPD. They weren't really large effects, but because we're in drought environments and those propagation effects of how a canopy develops, you then put transpiration rate or limitation on top of it, you then generate a huge amount. So probably the best example that's published at the moment is the one that Charlie Messina published with Graham Hammer and Crop Science on canopy development in maize about 3 or 4 years ago, 2012, I